Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. As we round out what has been an incomparable financial year in so many ways, our focus today is fixed on Australia's favourite asset class, property. For the fiscal 2021 year, it has certainly been a surprisingly strong one, given the pandemic uncertainties that are still overshadowing the economy. Looking at you, Sydney. Sydney home prices, for that matter, surged 15% in the financial year, defying early pandemic warnings of steep falls as ultra-low interest rates and government stimulus triggered a buying frenzy. All capitals ended up in the financial year with double-digit price growth, except for Melbourne and Perth, and nationally, dwelling prices jumped by 13.5%, the highest annual growth rate in over 20 years. As Australian house prices continue their seemingly inexorable climb, there is only one slight consolation. Households have now saddled themselves with so much housing-related debt that it will only require a gentle tug on the reins to bring the economy to heel. There has been a calculation that the cash rate that would be required to lift interest rates as a share of household disposable income to around 5%, which is a common target to help moderate house prices, has been calculated to be 1.25% at the RBA end. Now, this is a third of what would have been required two decades ago, so clearly debt levels have come a long way. It's also easy to see that restrictive regulations are also a leading reason why supply of new housing has failed to keep pace with demand from high population growth and strong immigration levels before the pandemic. But will the reluctance by both mainstream political parties to let housing behave like a healthy market and fall, resetting the market, exacerbate Australia's housing affordability problem, and allow the gap between the home ownership haves and have-nots to widen? Here to give us all the inside track on the latest in Australian property news, we have our chief economist, Leith Van Onselen, and here to share his thoughts on our thoughts on the future of Australian property and how it may influence our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. So we're going to kick off with the strongest property price growth since 1989. We're going to roll around then to the mortgage market, which is booming. Some words around that. Having a look at the economy, which is also booming. Zeroing in on the lack of supply and then finishing off with a look to the future and some thoughts on how long this boom can run. So on that note, we'll hand over to Leith and you can get the ball rolling, Leith. Some opening remarks.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. So I just want to reiterate that this podcast is based on a report that I've written for Macro Business that will go live early next week. And it's basically a look at the Australian property market through the first half of this year and obviously its immediate prospects and a look at each capital city, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I just want to say from the outset that the last 6 months' property price increases, so up to the June 30, has been obviously remarkable. We've basically experienced a coast-to-coast property boom, regional and city. Every single market across Australia has experienced close to double-digit price returns. Now, across the nation, Australian dwelling values rose by more than 12%, just over 12%. Regional areas look slightly stronger than capital cities, but both over 12%. And that is the strongest property price growth for 6 months that we've experienced since 1989.
Wow. Yep.
So we are looking at the strongest property price boom for, you know, in living memory for a lot of people, for generations. And it's also arguably the broadest property price boom we've experienced for generations as well, given that every single market has basically risen. It is quite extraordinary. Now, I think it's worth at this point to now look at what's effectively driving this boom.
Yep.
So if we skip across, obviously the number one factor is cheap credit. So since the pandemic began, we've seen mortgage rates, obviously the cash rate has fallen to 0.1%. We've seen mortgage rates across the board, owner occupiers, investors, fixed and variable, all fall quite sharply. In particular, fixed rate mortgages have fallen the most, because the Reserve Bank's term funding facility, which basically let commercial banks borrow off it for 0.1%, which effectively replaced their more expensive wholesale funding and allowed them to provide cheaper mortgages. And the sharp decline in mortgage rates has actually driven debt repayments. So that's principal and interest repayments as a share of household disposable income to 17-year lows. Mm. And it's also driven mortgage interest payments, so not including principal, to 21-year lows.
Wow.
So effectively, households who had existing mortgages now can have had a big rise in their disposable income, or they're not paying as much for the mortgages. Obviously, those who want to enter the market can do so more cheaply, provided they can find a deposit. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the cost, it's effectively never been an easier time to service a mortgage, or hasn't been an easier time to service a mortgage for a long, long time. Provided you can find that deposit, obviously. Basically the key driver of this is obviously easy credit. Mm. If we just skip along the next slide there, Jayden.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just some of the stuff we look at, I look at in terms of the house pricing, and this is all on our house price calculator that's you sort of get off the website, is what we're trying to do there is forecast house prices and say, or give you, sorry, give well, less so forecast, but give you the tools to play with in terms of saying, okay, if interest rates are doing this and you know, the average mortgage rate does whatever, you know, what does that mean for house prices? So that you can sort of play around with the inputs and see what the outputs are. But one of the key things is there's just an extraordinary divergence in the gross yield you can get from a property. So in terms of, you know, the absolute amount you can yield on a property has never been lower, but the yield versus the interest rate has never been better. Like so the gross yield has never been worse for you as an investor, but the yield versus interest rate has never been better for you as an investor. There's a few ones just in terms of that, as Leith was saying, you know, never been worse time to have to save to buy a property or get a deposit. But it's, you know, in some markets, it's never been better for affordability in terms of being able to service that mortgage. Having said that, the last couple of months, that's reversed a lot in some of these markets as prices are cooking up. And so you got most of that gain last year. And then this year, prices are obviously rising and you're starting to get in, mortgage rates start to tick up.
Is there some value in the thought that, so obviously the RBA's, you know, smashed the rates, and that obviously puts a lot of takes the handbrake off essentially for mortgage payments, doesn't it? Which obviously, you know, given the pandemic and all the rest of it, makes a lot of sense. And they've obviously helped pretty much as they can, I think, without going negative. What we're seeing now, though, is that help phase has been helpful, and now it's becoming harm phase, because would you agree? So basically, you know, people have had more money in their back pocket because, you know, they've had this big discount and obviously in their, you know, variable rates. But now it's turning into your fixed rate. But now it's actually turning around and becoming a harm factor, because people are going, oh, hang on a second, now I can borrow even more than I could previously. Do you think that's sort of the case, or is it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is obviously all this cheap money, et cetera, has encouraged more people in the market, and that's obviously bid up prices, and it's going to create a longer term issue down the track. Because as prices ratchet up, obviously it's
debt levels ratchet up.
Yeah, that's it. So you know, debt levels ratchet up, and it makes it harder for the next generation. But that's basically what we've had the last 20 years. I mean, this is nothing different. Mm. But for right now, it's obviously a pretty bullish market. And of course, obviously the more debt levels ratchet up, the more sensitive people become to changes in interest rates. And the fall in mortgage rates has been a pretty strong tailwind, mm-hmm. obviously, in the last year and the last multiple years. And once mortgage rates begin to edge higher, whether that's, you know, fixed rates because the term funding facility's ended or stop taking new applications, or because the RBA eventually raises the cash rate, it's mm-hmm. going to obviously come back to bite.
Yep.
But for the here and now.
And having said that, though, it's just limiting their ability to raise rates again, though, isn't it? Like, you know, I guess the RBA aren't going to raise rates for the sake of it. They'd obviously like to have higher rates, more normalized rates, but if by raising it by 50 basis points, they're going to smash the housing market. Well, they'll only raise by 25, and they won't have to do anywhere near as much as what they would have done.
Or alternatively, once they raise rates and then we get another downturn, it could be another repeat of the COVID downturn or one before that after the Royal Commission, they can just go to negative interest rates, which would be the next step because, we'll just repeat the cycle again.
Yep.
But, that was going to be top out. I don't want to get too far ahead because that was going to be how long can this boom last?
Yeah, on the actual prices though as well. So, very much driven by houses. As opposed to apartments.
Yeah, so certainly houses are a lot stronger. Regional's actually been slightly stronger than capital cities, but apartments are also rising outside of Sydney and Melbourne, just not nearly as big a pace. So it's pretty much detached houses and. Regional more than capital city, but both really strong. It's broad.
If you're looking for causes, I guess I'd look and say, okay, yes, the interest rates have certainly had a decent amount to do with it, but there's also this structural issue of more people now want, because people have been stuck in lockdowns, more people now want houses, and houses, there's a whatever it is year long. Process to get them built, so we've got a structural sort of shift, and I don't know if it's quite, we've been talking about our inventory super cycle in this extra demand for things, but there's one part of it's a shorter term structural change there, and then there's that other shorter term structural change when people want to move from cities to regional areas, and again. Although we do have, there are a lot of restrictions in terms of building in a lot of these regional areas, there are acres and acres of land. If you wanted to, you could certainly expand a lot more quickly than you can, say, in the middle of Sydney or Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the question is, how much of this do you think is interest rates and how much of it is structural change in terms of the what people are demanding is different and the supplies, it takes a long time to come on?
I think it's 90% interest rates right now.
Yeah.
That structural stuff's going to come back to bite. But
90% interest rates, but then how does that explain why apartments haven't really moved?
No, apartments have gone up. They just haven't. I mean, Melbourne apartments, not so much, but
Sydney apartments haven't moved much.
No, but Melbourne houses have rocketed, and Melbourne's negative migration.
Exactly.
Negative internal migration. We've lost population here.
But I guess that's what I'm saying is interest rates certainly have a deal in terms of the whole market. If you didn't have low interest rates, then nothing could move up. But there has to be a certain amount where you say, well, if this asset's hardly rising, this other one's rising at double digits, then there must be a certain amount of it that's a structural change in people's preferences.
Oh, yeah. No, it's definitely that. But if we're talking about the whole market, right, if you look at dwelling values nets out detached houses, nets out apartments, right? So if Australian dwelling values have risen 12% plus and apartments have risen 6 and houses have risen 15, whatever, it nets out anyway. So interest rates are still the driver.
Yes.
Still the
predominant driver. Right?
Obviously the predominant driver. I mean, there is some of this other stuff and some of this other stuff I'll get into in just a sec, but first and foremost, it's interest rates and if anyone's watching live, they can see the chart here of mortgage finance, which in response to the interest rates, in response to people not being able to spend anywhere else, in response to, all these factors, but mostly interest rates, mortgage demand has rocketed to levels that we've never seen before. Mm. Literally, it's almost double year on year. And it's been driven mostly by owner-occupiers, but in the last few months, we've seen investor mortgages now return basically to their 2015 peak.
Mm.
So owner-occupiers' mortgages are running way above their previous peaks and investor mortgages are basically back to their past peak. And the other factor, as I say, 90% interest rates, that's obviously the demand side, but also we've had a big shrinkage in the market supply. So this is different to structural supply, actually building homes, but homes listed for sale are tracking 25% below the 5-year average.
Yeah.
So we've got this, and my view is that this is creating a sort of sense of FOMO.
Yep.
In that you've got a whole bunch of people wanting to get in. They got access to, once in a lifetime low interest rates, etc.
Yep.
But there aren't nearly as many homes listed on the market. Part of that's because people are worried if they sell, they've got to buy into the same market. and they don't think they can afford it.
Yep.
Or they could just be hanging on for higher prices. It could be a whole bunch of reasons. And obviously, low interest rates, if you're if you're land banking, for example, it makes holding land cheaper as well.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever the case, you've got this record mortgage demand butting heads with the lowest supply on record. The records don't obviously go back that far, but, you know, 25% below the five-year average.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, you know, it's this classic supply-demand situation there in the market. And obviously, if you're looking at places like Melbourne and Sydney, which are auction-based, you can create a lot of competitive pressure very quickly.
Mm.
And we've seen that in Sydney, which has led the nation pretty much, going absolutely gangbusters. Melbourne has been held down a bit more because of the pandemic, et cetera. But you know, this rampacious demand meeting, you know, limited market supply is creating is obviously creating tightness in the market and bidding up prices. And if we add to that, if we just skip along to the next one, thanks. Same at the same time, because of the ginormous amount of COVID stimulus we got last year, household finances are actually booming right now. So household disposable income had its biggest increase pretty much, I think, since the GFC in the year to March off the back of stimulus. So we effectively, disposable income basically flatlined for a decade or so, and it's risen quite sharply because households and the economy is pumped with all this extra money.
Mm-hmm.
Households
they,
also
they can't spend it.
Yeah, yeah, and obviously they couldn't spend it because it was lockdowns, etc. Yeah. And they're also and so households actually in the year to March 2021 accumulated $200 billion worth of savings. So now that's money that's obviously available now. It's basically pent up stimulus.
Yeah.
So it's stimulus that hasn't been spent yet, and that's even though JobKeeper and JobSeeker and all these other things have ended. That's money that is effectively that can be spent now.
Yeah.
Australians can't travel overseas. A lot of them have got this money and they're going, well, I'll put into housing, whether it's renovations or buying a house, whatever.
Yep.
So they're in obviously a pretty strong financial position there. And that's arguably giving them more confidence to go out and push up property values. And if we just skip along the next one, at the same time, which builds in that same theme, we've got the tightest labour market conditions on record. So the unemployment rate, the underutilisation rate has fallen to around, you know, pre-COVID levels. Well, underutilisation a bit lower. But more importantly, the number of unemployed people and underemployed people per job has fallen to the lowest level since record. Per job vacancy has mm-hmm. fallen to the lowest level since records began in 1983. So, which means that getting a job's more easier. A lot easier for people.
Yep.
But at the same time, it also should put upward pressure on wages, which would then also feed into household disposable income.
See, I've got a little bit of a pushback on this one. Not that I think it's. I think you're in the right direction, but I guess my issue is, I guess without taking people too far, the beverage curve, and basically it's this relationship between jobs and job apps.
Skills mismatches.
Yeah, that's right. And so it's sort of saying, okay, well, when there's lots of job ads, you get low unemployment. When you don't have many job ads, then you get high unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed the US, and I'm just looking at the US data, they took this structural, after the financial crisis, they took this structural jump upwards, I guess my explanation for it is, you had a lot of people who were out building houses pre that who now didn't have a job and they needed to learn how to whatever code or they needed to learn how to, you know,
reskill,
serve coffees or whatever it was. And so, and then it took sort of 10 years for it to get back to its ordinary line, and it just reached the sort of the ordinary line. And then now we've had this next one and a bigger jump where I guess you know, your average flight hostess, for example, has
can't
a job
suddenly
anymore
become a nurse.
Exactly. Yeah. Now needs to retrain. And so there's like this structural change. And I guess that's what I'm just not sure about in terms of the so it's the highest on record, but we had relatively weak wage growth posts, and that's what I'm just not quite sure whether that necessarily means strong wage growth. And then the other part is
it doesn't necessarily mean strong, but it's stronger. Like you've got to have upward pressure on wages, and a lot of that's because the borders closed immigration. I mean, look, yeah, we are seeing shortages across the board. Professed shortages, I should say, across the board from industry. Everyone's complaining they can't get the workers they want. Part of that's because they don't want to pay more. But I mean, the chart on the right up here, which tracks the number of unemployed per job vacancy or underutilization per job vacancy, that's just raw numbers. So that's the all I've done there is I've taken the unemployed number as measured by the ABS, the underemployed plus unemployed number as measured by the ABS, and then divided it by the ABS job ad series. So it doesn't account for mismatches, all that sort of stuff. It's just a raw number. But regardless, it's, you know, it is the tightest it's been on record. And I did some separate analysis today for macro business, and basically across every single market or every single mainland market, whether it's, you know, New South Wales, Victoria, WA, South Australia, whatever, they're all close to the lowest level on record. WA and Queensland are slightly higher. I got slightly more slack than they had pre-GFC, but everywhere else is the lowest since 1983.
So is it WA and Queensland, did you say?
Yeah.
Which the mining states sound
That's right, yeah. So WA, I think, had 1.5 unemployed per job vacancy now, and then pre-GFC, it was like 1.4. Yeah, and Queensland was,
so
you know,
back similar. In the boom again.
But either way, it's tight everywhere. And
you've probably got that limitation where, and I count myself in this in the 2000s, where, you know, there was a flood of eastern staters into Perth, right?
Yeah.
You can't do that anymore. You almost don't want to, because as soon as you cross a straight line, as we know at the moment with Sydney, you might not be able to come back, or it's a real pain to come back. So it's a big step, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it's tight across the board. So I guess my point is we've got obviously cheap money, you've got limited stock available to buy, you've got households awash with cash because of the stimulus.
Yep.
And they've saved a lot of that because they couldn't spend it, they can't spend it overseas and whatever. And then at the same time, you've got a really tight labour market. So fairly strong tailwinds there.
Yep.
But, I mean, obviously, there is a but coming. So it's not all me going, yeah, this is all good, good, good. I'm sort of trying to present the drivers, and then we can get into the other stuff.
Okay. And the other one, I mean, the one I'm interested in, we're obviously, have a few travel stocks. And so with this, I guess, this view that people have all this pent-up savings, and there's a lot of, grandparents who haven't been able to visit grandkids. There's a lot of people who want to get out and travel, a lot of, retirees who are like, I've missed 2 years worth of traveling. I'm going to make it up. I wanted to go to all these things. I'm going to make it up by traveling more. And so I guess there's this, for me, it's saying, I wonder, is there a tied out perspective as well in terms of this? There's this pent up demand, which is going into housing loan because it can't go anywhere. But if once opening up happens, and Australia's probably a lot further away than others, but whether you're like, okay, well, there's an amount of money which might have gone into housing, which is actually now going to go into travel because people can,
sure.
And so they'll...
So at the moment, this is kind of related to that point, but closed borders are actually... If we didn't have to shut down the state borders, closed borders would actually be really good for Australia's tourism industry, because Australians spend twice as much overseas normally than they spend here.
And part of that's just that you might be saving yourself $1,000 air ticket each.
Yeah, that's it. And you can spend it locally.
Like you've turned it into a $1,000 air ticket into a $200 air ticket, and you spend the rest of the money still on your holiday. But
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. But Australians spend twice as much overseas as what foreign tourists spend here in a normal year.
Yeah.
So when you've got a closed border, you've actually got more money being spent domestically. And that can be spent not just on, obviously, tourism, but housing and all the other stuff. I think that's definitely a factor. And obviously, when people are given more choice, and if the international border opens up and people can travel freely again, whatever, you're going to have an unwinding of this impact.
Yep.
But at the same time, you could also see more money come in from, more migration, obviously,
which is
a positive factor, but... Obviously, it's been overwhelmed at the moment by this stuff.
Yep.
And potentially, more foreign investment stuff as well. So,
just on that topic, there's a question here from Geordie. Thanks, Geordie. Is this sugar hit going to leave people caught out as stimulus is spent and leveraged and not replenished?
Look, I mean, look, there's. I'm basically looking ahead about 12 months, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, because honestly, making predictions and forecasts is pretty much a fool's game. the best of times, and I've got an egg on my face a few times and whatever, because you just know what goes in and you're trying to look at what's going on and you're making guesses. So, yeah, I mean, my views were that the next 12 months in terms of property, the economy is looking pretty good. Mm. After that, we're going to get a comeuppance for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, so households have saved $200 billion in stimulus as of the March quarter.
Mm-hmm.
That's eventually going to be depleted.
Yep.
But there's enough in there to give you a good 12 months.
Yeah, sure.
Definitely there's going to be a comeuppance for sure. But I just don't think it's going to be in the next, not until after the next election, by the way.
Yep, okay.
And I think as well, although there's this amount saved, it's important as well to recognise, I guess, that it's a distribution that matters, isn't it? Like if you said, okay, if it's all going to Gina Runhart and a couple of, property moguls, then it's not going to get spent. Like, you know, that's just them saving. They're not going to spend. They're not going to rush out and spend it. But if it's getting spread pretty broadly, and this amount, the amounts we had so far were spread pretty broadly, and it does seem as if it's still, like you'd be thinking that your poorer people will be running down that balance, or maybe even never had it. They just got the money and spent it. And then, but it's really this middle class, isn't it, that's saying, okay, well, they've saved up the money and they're outspending, and they're the one that's bidding up the house prices as opposed to unit prices and people trying to get families and they're the ones not traveling who might have otherwise traveled. And then, so it's a question about saying, well, for me, they're the ones I'm really watching in terms of seeing, will this house price keep going? Because if it starts being that they start running their savings down, and you start going, okay, now it's only the really rich people because company profits are so great that are picking up. Then they're not going to be able to drive the housing market by themselves.
No, absolutely.
Maybe the high end, but the sort of broader part of it's not. And I would guess that the lower part has already started depleting their savings if they ever had the savings in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this will be driven by the middleman. Like the wealthiest aren't going to drive the market. They're just going to chuck it on the pile. Which is basically always the case. And there is another dimension to this too. Obviously, the big rise in household savings has gone in the banking system as deposits, which obviously helps them, gives them an easier, cheap, easy source of funding, which they can then lend out mortgages as well. So you know, it's a fantastic circular system we've got going here at the moment.
Yep.
So there you go, We'll just skip ahead. So I won't run down too much longer on this, then we can talk about the good stuff.
Yep. On the questions as well. If you like, we've got one more here from Mike. Probably just to put it into a reference. So obviously, we've got the RBA at all-time lows, jawboning some slowdown in their largesse, I guess, over the next 6 to 12 months. Bond buying is going to be reduced in
taper.
September. The taper, yes.
The taper, yeah.
Couple of levers that they, or a couple of factors they look at is obviously the employment rate, and obviously as you mentioned, it's all time low, so they've got a big tick there. I'm not too sure.
Waiting for wage growth, though.
Wage price.
But they actually want to see it before they act, so they're not just doing it on forecasts anymore. Phil Lowe explicitly said in his statement of monetary policy decision the other day, explicitly said, we've got to see wage growth rise, we're going to see inflation pressures hit.
Yes,
and we're not going to act until we've seen it.
Until they actually see it,
rather than expecting it. Because I think they recognise that their forecasts suck, and that they've basically produced like wage growth like this as its treasury for a decade and never happened.
Yeah.
So they actually said they're going to before they move, they're going to actually wait to see it.
Yep. Okay.
So
just on that, so obviously wage increases pushes through money and pushes up inflation. And so Mike's just asked a question here, restructural change, should or will the government include property in CPI calculations, inflation calculations? Would this be a better reflection of our economy in real terms?
Yeah, they probably should but they won't.
Yeah.
So pretty much they only measure rents.
Yep.
And cost of construction. In the CPI.
So they try and keep capital out of it.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And it's kind of an international standard, so it's kind of hard to, for Australia to go another way. I mean, maybe they should do an alternative inflation measure which counts that, but the CPI, they're not going to bother.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're doing that as well, you could argue that, well, maybe we should put the share market in and, you know, and other assets, you know, that
you Although you don't live in your share.
But... No, but, you know, you might live off your dividends or selling. Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is a lot of people who have big share portfolios. So there's sort of that there's that issue about what are you spending versus what are you how much money's out there. And I think that's been our argument all along, which I think Mike's sort of picking up on, is that if there's a lot of money out there, it can go in two places. It can either end up in asset markets and bid assets up, or it can end up in people's pockets who then go out and spend it on consumption.
Yep.
And the issue we've had is that it's going into asset markets, and partly now because people can't spend it on things they want to spend it on, which is travel and other services. So
it's turbocharging the assets even more.
Yeah. So just... I've just done some quick charts in the rental market. So basically, the rental growth is at its strongest pace. I think I don't have my glasses on, so I think it says 2009 on there. But basically, every rental market other than every house rental market is going up solid to strong. So it's experiencing strong growth.
Mm-hmm.
On the unit side. Everywhere bar Sydney and Melbourne apartments has had a decent rental growth, but all of them have shown an improving trend.
Yep.
Over recent months, and despite that though, despite the property market obviously rising so strongly in values, gross rental yields are actually still pretty high outside of Sydney and Melbourne. So basically, you can get 4% plus gross rental yields everywhere other than Sydney and Melbourne across Australia. Mm. So that also kind of, it's a pretty crude measure of valuation, but it sort of shows that outside of Sydney and Melbourne, there's still opportunities for neutral to positive cash flow investing or buying.
Yep.
So it's neutral or positive, like cheaper to actually buy a house than to rent it in outside of Sydney and Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's actually acting, also a factor in why there's such strong property price demand, and that then feeds, obviously, is caused by the low mortgage rates.
Yep.
So because money is so cheap, if you live outside of Sydney and Melbourne, buying a place rather than renting it is almost a no-brainer. Mm. If you want to
stay there long term,
obviously, if it's transient, you just want to live somewhere for a short time, or you're going to be switching jobs, etc. Renting's still good, but outside of Sydney and Melbourne, buying's neutral or cheaper than renting. Most of the time,
before you go to Bunnings,
and of course, that doesn't mean every suburb's like that. Like some are obviously higher yields than others, but broad brush strokes, that's the way it is. And I'm sure that's why another reason why property demand's so high and people are trying to get in, because it's like, well, you know, why pay this rent money is dead money thing when you can just buy in and get in before the prices rise further.
Yep.
All this FOMO stuff.
Oh, that's right.
And sorry, but just define a few terms there. FOMO is this fear of missing out.
Sorry.
So it's the idea that markets are driven by either fear or greed, and at the moment, greed has the upper hand.
Mm.
That's it. People buying in before prices rise further, and they get locked out forever.
Yep.
So it's a particular phenomenon in places like Sydney and Melbourne, which run on auctions. So all it takes is to miss one or two auctions. And you realize, and then you start worrying you're never going to get in, and you get the disappointment, and then you want to go to the next place, and you probably bid more than you should.
Yeah, that's right.
Start
bidding hot to lock that in. All right, very good. Thanks, mate.
Let's move along. I think, this is the all important question. How long can the boom last? We've already kind of touched on it, I guess. Look. My view is, so I've already seen about 12% price growth the first half of this year. Now, this is guessing, right? Obviously, this is guessing game. But my view is we're going to get pretty strong property growth over the second half, not as strong as the first.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to take a stab in the dark at the national growth rate next 6 months, I'd say probably 8%.
Wow.
Just based on current momentum, et cetera. And then to slow rapidly into next year. And the reason for that is... Phil Lowe, and who's the chair of the Council of Financial Regulators, that's RBA, Treasury, ASIC, APRA, has said on multiple occasions that that the RBA won't raise interest rates until they see what I mentioned before, wages pick up, and inflation pick up, yep. and they won't actually see it. So, and he said that probably not going to raise interest rates for a couple of years,
mm.
but he's also said that they are watching mortgage standards
mm-hmm.
and the quantity of mortgage lending. And what we saw in the May mortgage finance data, which came out a couple of weeks back, is we saw investors pile back in big time.
Yep.
Like investors have been kind of largely out of the market a bit. It started to stir a little bit in the last few months, but last month they rocketed.
Yeah,
right. And it's now up to basically 2015 levels, the 2015 peak. Year on year, investor mortgages went up, I think, about 120%.
Mm-hmm.
But that is albeit comparing to last May, which was a low point. And I think that's, I've got no doubt that would have spooked the regulators a bit. They're going, oh, geez, investors are coming back. And I believe they'll end up acting with towards the end of the year, even before the election. The Council of Financial Regulators, and Phil has already kind of hinted at it, will implement some kind of macroprudential curve. So whether that's loan value ratio limits, limits on interest-only lending, interest rate buffers, debt to income, serviceability mm. barriers, some kind of something to dampen the mortgage market and aimed at squarely investors. They've done it before. They did it, pre-Banking Royal Commission. They've taken this action before, and I think that'll be their likely move rather than raising mortgage rates. And if that does come into effect towards the end of the year, that's obviously going to dampen the mortgage market and weigh on house prices next year.
Mm.
On top of that, the term funding facility is now not taking any more applications. So we're likely to see, and we're already starting to see it, some fixed mortgage rates are going to tick up.
Yep.
Which will also, about 40% of new mortgages at the moment, 30% of new mortgages at the moment are fixed. So obviously if you raise the fixed mortgage rate, even if the variable stays the same, that's an increase in overall mortgage costs.
Hmm.
So that should also dampen the market.
It's funny like that though, because if someone wants to buy a house, obviously you're incentivized by rates being at, getting a rate home loan at 2.5% rather than 5%. That makes a lot of sense.
It's currently about 2% for fixed.
Yeah,
so it's incredibly cheap.
But if it goes to 2.1 or 2.2 or 2.3, is that going to actually, do you think, arguably provide enough handbrake on it? Like, or is it more that they need to go to 3? So it needs to take a couple of years for that for that rise.
I guess this is the problem, because we're dealing with such low mortgage rates at the moment, even small changes are decent in percentage terms.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So obviously people are way more sensitive now.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, a couple of years ago, if you did a 0.25%, if the RBA lifted the cash rate by 0.25, it has X impact.
Yeah.
Now it's like 2X.
Yeah, that's right.
Because rates are half what they were back then. And obviously debt levels are higher. So, this is all stuff at the margin. But when you look at them combined, if you've got obviously rising fixed mortgage rates, even if it's only, 20 basis points, 30 basis points, whatever, on top of macroprudential, which makes it harder to get a loan or makes it more expensive, those two things combined will weigh on the market, no doubt about it. Easy money's driven this thing. If you make it a little bit less easy, it's going to then obviously put downward pressure.
Yep.
But can I as well define, what you really want, if you're a property investor, what you really want now is you want economic conditions to be relatively bad, but not so bad that it damages house prices, because then the RBA will keep throwing more money at it. Because the issue is if the economy becomes strong, then they will start raising rates, and then that sort of very much puts this cap on house prices. Of the arguments Leith was saying when people look and go mortgage to rent, we absolutely think that's a key factor for people, is saying how much am I paying on mortgage versus how much I'm paying rent. But you raise rates by 50 basis points, and all of a sudden that, because rates are so low, all of a sudden that flips to from being all of a sudden flips from being close to as low as it's ever been to high, much, much, much higher. And actually, I must admit it, I think on my latest numbers, the Sydney housing market is now already at the 70th percentile of where it's traded on the mortgage to rent. So it used to, most of these other markets are trading sort of in their, the lowest percentile, the sort of 10 to 25%. So very, very cheap. But the Sydney housing market's already, because the rents aren't that, the rents are quite low and the prices have moved a lot. They're already saying, well, now you're actually in the, even though we've got record low mortgage rates, you're actually in the the top 30% of how expensive the Sydney housing market is relative to rents.
Yeah, and that's actually that's obviously reflected in the rental yields. So Sydney's rental yields are lowest on record. I think it's 2.8%. Melbourne, I think it's 2.9, or maybe it's 2.7, 2.8. They're both very close.
Yeah.
And you know, whereas it's 4% plus everywhere else. So it's just these two markets are the most overvalued.
But I do want to say as well, 4%. As in the long term, is lower than property yields.
Of course, it's only viable because we've got such cheap mortgage rates.
Exactly,
that's the only reason. I mean, you know, but there is another fact I want to add on. So the way I see it is, just to summarise that, we're probably going to have ratchet up in average mortgage rates because the term funding facility has ended, et cetera. Even if they don't, RBA doesn't raise the cash rate for a couple of years, and then. Macroprudential probably towards the end of the year. I think they'll be forced into doing it.
I was going to say, it's almost certainly, because set me on the other side, I guess, and this will get a chuckle out of you fellas, but if you've got the prospect of rising investment loan rates, right, that's just increasing your ability to negatively gear. Like, you know, if you're positively geared and it suddenly rises to a point where you're negatively geared, isn't that one of the whole reasons why everyone was getting into property investment anyway, back provided these record low rates? Like, you know, I know it's not the same, but from a pub test point of view, you know, is it going to slow you down unless you're physically stopped at the door of the bank by macroprudential?
Yeah, that's a good point. And the other thing on that, I've been having this debate in my head, I was like, well, will they do it before the election? But in some ways, I think it'd almost be electorally expedient for them to do it before the election, because that way, you know, Scott Morrison, when he fronts the Australian people next year, early next year, whatever, for the election, can say, oh, look, we're taking action on housing affordability. You know, the regulators stepping in to blah, blah, blah. Whereas if he does nothing, it might actually raise more questions. But I don't think...
Sorry, you're suggesting he's going to take action?
No.
Is this because he announced he might take action?
No. He won't take action, but he can point to the regulators for doing it. So he can basically spin a positive story around it.
Right.
Whereas initially I thought, I think they'll probably wait to the election next year.
Yeah.
But I don't think the election's a barrier.
He needs some sort of big leap to say we're doing something about housing affordability. Without actually doing anything about
house it. House prices will never be lower under a government. But he'll do something to stop them being too
high. He's not actually going to do it. But I guess my point was, a part of me was thinking, the election's going to be a barrier to the regulators moving, but I don't think it will be. Because Scott Morrison can spin it anyway. Well,
and the thing is, Labor's not going to go to this election. Like they went to last election with policies that were negative for housing. They're not going to go this time. And so there's no, I guess what I'm saying is you might actually end up the opposite problem, that they're both coming out, trying to come out with policies that are they're going to push house prices even further.
Yeah.
But there's... Because they're basically, you know, Labor said, okay, we're not going to try and defend the, we need to bring housing affordability because we lost the last election on it. So let's just copy
And the most likely route for that is first home buyer bribes, because it works. You know, we know it works. It's good for juice in the market, and it's good for, you know, it gives good optics.
Yep. Okay.
There is one last thing on it. So basically, pretty strong for the second half, about 8%. That's my guess. Like, it's just a guess, guys. Okay. Versus 12% the first half, but then slowing through next year because of these factors. And there is another factor which we kind of touched on earlier, if we skip ahead, and is also we're going to be hit with a flood of new supply of homes next year. So as we know, immigration's fallen to zero in the year to December, or year to March, I think it was the latest figures. It's basically been running negative quarter on quarter for the last few quarters. Population growth's very, very low at the moment. At the same time, because of home builder, the federal government's brought forward a hell of a lot of construction. Now, a lot of that hasn't hit the market yet because it's been built. It's been approved and it's under construction now, but a lot of that will hit the market next year. So I've got this situation where we're going to be hit with a whole bunch of new homes hitting the market next year, which will obviously, with the absence of immigration is going to lead to more supply in the market. Like, talking about structural supply, you're not number of homes for sale. And that should, other things equal, you know, add a little further headwind to property values next year, because you'll have, it should put downward pressure on rents and also prices at the margin. Mm. Although, that factor obviously is not as important as the whole interest rate story, but it's just another little headwind that should that should push down price growth next year. Not so much of an impact this year though, because most of the homes won't be built till next year.
Gotcha.
So okay. That's just one final thing. Reason why the outlook next year is probably, you know, okay growth, but pretty sluggish. And then if I had to guess now, I'd say 2023 is going to be a negative year and we're going to have some decent price falls.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, like similar to previous downturns.
Yeah.
But this is like, this is me navigating way ahead and so much stuff could happen between now and then. So who knows? But if I had to guess, it'd be slowing next year into by the end of next year, it's starting to go to zero to negative.
Yep.
And then we have another downturn like we had post-mining boom, COVID boom. Sorry, pre-Royal Commission, the last one with COVID, short, sharp downturn before the party starts again.
And your upside case is what I was talking about before, which is such a weak economy and such weak recovery that they keep throwing more stimulus and they keep throwing everything at the – keep interest rates really low. And then the issue with the housing market is if it goes on either side of that, so if it's much weaker than that or if it's much stronger than that, then you start getting negative outcomes for the housing market.
So you almost want Goldilocks. Goldilocks economy for the housing market is a sluggish economy with stimulus and monetary support.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. A couple of questions. I have to say these names sometimes in my head before I say them out loud. Chittis T, just to make sure it's okay on the radio. Is this bubble sustainable in the long run? When the younger generation can't afford to enter the market, how would this play out in the future?
Oh, look, it stinks. There's no other way to put it. Just why I was like, you know, spent 10 years campaigning against this bad boy, and now it's kind of, to be honest with you, I'm just burnt out by it. But, yeah, look, I guess if you take a really, really long-term view, no, it's probably not. But it could run for a long time. And you know, my old view was, once the cash rate gets to zero, that's game over because they can't keep lowering it. Well, we've seen what the European Central Bank has done and, you know, I guess Japan before that. There's nothing to stop the central bank from going into negative rates and basically paying banks to lend.
Yep.
And I think that'll be the next step. So, if I had to navel goes ahead and guess, the next round we'll see, like 2023, we'll get price falls again. The economy will hit the skids. The RBA will just go into negative interest rate territory and then they'll kick off another period of rising prices like we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll get another downturn and then, I don't know, like it'll have to end eventually. Like there'll have to be some kind of accident eventually.
Yep.
But you know, it could be another decade away. Who knows? It could be like we don't know when it's going to be. Well,
and it's the point with every sort of asset bubble you look at is they can, some of them do end by prices just sort of moving sideways and for a long, long time. And then, you know, wages will pick up, rents will pick up. And so then, you know, 10 years of that and then they don't look as expensive.
Yeah, that's
right. So you can see that. But quite a lot of these as well is when you hit an accident, it's
like an external shock, you mean?
An external shock. Yeah. It's a question about how severe that external shock is. And then, can that sort of pull the rug out before the central banks and governments have time to act? I think what the coronavirus really showed was they're moving fast.
Yeah.
They're no longer saying, oh, let's wait and see how this works out. They're saying, well, no, we don't want to let bad things happen. So
shovel money into the furnace.
Let's yeah, go. Which means it's a big, you know, it's really about moral hazard now, is how much moral hazard a society is willing to put up with in order to have stable economies. And saying, you know, companies that make bad mistakes or make mistakes or over leverage or individuals that over leverage, will, if things go wrong, will we bail them out?
Yep.
Or are we prepared to wear that risk? And I think what's happened overseas is once you start down the route of bailing out and not and then the moral hazard route of saying we're not going to let people go broke and we're going to keep companies afloat that maybe should have gone bust, is that it's a pretty steady thing to do and economies can last for a long, long period of time. And yes, young people get very upset about the whole thing, but then again, younger people eventually get older and
intergenerational wealth transfer.
And parents die and pass on. And so not, obviously it's not a good thing for society in terms of mobility and all these types of things. Mm. But those types of issues take decades to play out before you actually have problems with yep. those. So, I guess what I'm saying is if you're prepared for the fact that central banks are going to keep bailing things out every time anything looks down, then you might end up with a long period of sideways movements, but that sort of keeps you in that period. And it's a question about.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, as you sort of think, well, at the moment, all the major growth levers for Australia, so immigration, zero, education, pretty much on its, on the ropes at the moment. Financial failure or banking failure is almost, a zero event anyway, because we seem to see the RBA just step in and back them anyway. Mm. What's left? like, is it a Martian landing or something? Like, it makes you think what kind of external factor there could be in that had popped the bubble, really, in the on the property game. I don't know. We've had a pandemic.
No, I don't know. It would probably be something you never thought of. Look, I mean, honestly, if I had to go back the time machine back to 2017 or something, and if you said to me, in 2021, there's going to be all this quantitative easing everywhere, and it's going to be this and that and that. I would have gone, get serious.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have thought it would happen back then. But then who knows what the next 10 years is going to be. Like, we'll see all sorts of funny stuff happen.
Yeah.
But I think the main thrust, though, is that it all comes down to how much you trust your governments and your central banks. And at the moment, they're all on the path of don't let house prices fall. The question about whether they can make them rise in the long term, I think, is probably saying no. I think there's certainly limitations on how much further they can make them rise, and they've pushed every lever they can. Now they actually need, at a certain stage, they need real growth in wages, real growth yep. in inflation. Mm-hmm. And without that, you just can't get sustainable long-term growth.
Yep.
And so they're the big ones we're looking for. Absent that, now we're just talking about saying, well, can they lower interest rates to zero? And if it's other areas of the economy that are going really badly, and so they're trying to prop up other areas, then maybe the housing market can stick on another 10-20% because they're just trying to juice something to get things going.
Mm.
But if it's a housing market that's the epicenter of everything, then there's other risks at play.
It's too big to fail.
Just finally, I guess if we'd just swing around to the portfolios, Damien, have we got some just a reflection on today's topic and how they play out in what we're doing at Nucleus Wealth?
Yeah, look, it certainly matters for the banks. But the big thing for the banks at the moment is flattening yield curves, because this is their funding issues. And so it's been very interesting, actually, because globally banks have been falling. And as yield curves have been flattening and people have this whole inflation scare sort of gave banks a bit of a boost, because they started looking at the bank's funding and going, when there's a bit of an inflation scare, long-term rates rise and short-term rates sort of stay where they are, and it's good for banks.
Okay.
As that's been reversing, the Australian banks have actually been doing all right. Mm. And globally, banks have been falling. So the Aussie banks are just getting more and more expensive relative to everyone else.
Right.
And so yep. there's a real question within that. So we've taken the opposite view and said, look, we've taken the view that that's not sustainable in Australia and that it's time to lighten up on those.
Okay.
I think within and that that extreme mortgage growth we've seen will taper back.
Taper back, yep.
So that's one side of it. Then you got to get around to your housing related stocks and start looking through those. And I think the thing for me on that side, we've already seen a lot of money spent on your Bunnings and your Harvey Normans and those ones. That was sort of like the one of the key places where people would spend money because they couldn't spend money elsewhere.
Yep.
Was, yes, can't travel, but you know what?
I had this house, I got to fix it up.
I had a $5,000 budget for my travel this year to, fly me and my family somewhere. And so let's buy a new lounge suite or let's, do whatever to.
Yep.
And so I think when we look at those parts, sort of housing related, we pull those back in terms of saying we don't think we think that's going to taper off as well, and you'll pick up more on the services side. So for us, it's about it's about saying, look, there's this boom going on. We don't think it's sustainable in the long term, mm-hmm. and so now it's a matter about how fast and how sharp it comes off, and trying to manage that. If it comes off too sharply, there's some accidents waiting to happen in those sectors.
Yep.
But if it sort of tails off, then we're expecting it to be a more gradual switch into other sectors is where you see the performance.
Okay. Yep. Great. And any other sort of sectors of note? Obviously, financials and discretionary is one area of the market. Where have we got any other sort of plays in force
for the Aussie housing market? No, not really. I think there's, there's certainly a REIT. Which is the Real Estate Investment Trust, but they tend to be very much commercially focused, and so there's issues there about. I think we're going to see lots of issues in terms of saying that the you've got a lot of rental pressure in commercial markets. And it makes sense for them, but usually in the past when that happens and you get all these vacancies, you get some conversions into houses. But the issue is people don't really want apartments at the moment anyway.
That's right.
So there's this real mismatch sort of stuck there between where the demand is and the whole immigration reopening is the other part. That's the other big factor is we really don't know where that's going. And so,
neither does Scott Morrison from Look at Things, but anyway.
No, that's right. I think that's a... I think both sides are waiting to see which way the weather vane blows, and whichever way sort of general consensus comes up, that's where they'll point. But I think they're I don't think either of them's. I think they're the Liberals in particular. Actually, no, I think both parties are predisposed to starting it again. But they're not so predisposed that if the weather vane blows in the opposite direction, they won't change that view.
The looming election that needs to be captured or retained. So, all right, very good. Look, I think that's it for time today, gents. And look, thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. Looking forward to the property report coming out. Is it Monday?
Hopefully Monday at this point. Probably early next week. So just keep your eye out for it. I'll just say in this report, I'm only looking sort of 12 months ahead because any further than that's a waste of time.
Well, look, these are pretty extraordinary times, so I think even 12 months is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah. So it basically just gives a rundown of all the indicators, all that sort of stuff, a discussion on in more detail on some of the points today.
Yep.
And a look at some of the individual capital cities, and then I'm going to roll out a whole bunch of specific individual reports on each major capital over the second half. So I'll look at Sydney first, then Melbourne, then Brisbane, then Perth and Adelaide, and go into some detail on those markets, partly because it's good fun.
Yeah.
So there you go. And I'm looking to actually do a report on the global property market. I've got to get the data though. It's a bit of it's a massive undertaking.
Well, you and thanks to you, Damien, for coming in as well. But you'll just as some form of a segue, you'll have to maybe pop in next Thursday for our next guest.
Ooh, nice.
So coming up next week, we have special guest William Digby, is Chief Investment Officer at Jamieson Capital Private Equity. William is a growth capital investor and entrepreneur, and his partner at Jamieson Capital, which is a private equity fund headquartered in Melbourne. He's led investments across many markets and sectors globally and was a former Green Beret commando for the Australian Army. William has some terrific experience in global and local real estate startups and ventures and marketing, so it could be worth a chat to him through his investments in his portfolio. And we cannot wait to find out his thoughts on the true impact of the pandemic on property, amongst other things, of course, along with the potential opportunities he sees and what gets him excited for the future. So thanks again to all those that watched in live and bear with us with our little bit of a tech foible there at the start. I'm glad we finally got up and away, so that was good. To all of those that asked questions, I hope I got through most of them. There was a terrific amount of interaction on the live stream chat. That was wonderful as well. Hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video now to give us some feedback. I've just been notified we do have a viewer question of the week as well, so feel free to drop in your answers to how long will the boom last. Pick a boom and pick a time frame. Drop it into the comments and we can take it from there. If you'd like to see more of our content, of course, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. Stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it. Share with a friend and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and we look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.
Nice. I was funny listening to the reading some of the chat.